Hi everyone, my name is Katie Colseth.
And I'm Leah Martinson.
Two senior international studies majors at Pepperdine University. Welcome to Global Tides, a podcast where we highlight the research and achievements of impressive members of the Pepperdine community.
Through this season of Global Tides, we hope to inspire empathy, encourage critical thinking, and broaden perspectives through an exploration of social science research and experiences.
This is episode 4.
Having an experienced, knowledgeable research mentor is an invaluable asset to writing a senior honors thesis, especially when your passions align. In today's episode, we sit down with Professor of Political Science here at Pepperdine, Dr. Carrie Riddle, and Senior Political Science Major Jessica Odishu to discuss their respective research.
Through their research and this discussion, Dr. Riddle and Jessica emphasize the often overlooked lived experiences of marginalized groups and encourage an intersectional perspective when tackling global issues.
Welcome back to Global Tides. We're your hosts, Leah Martinson.
And I'm Katie Colseth. Today we are so excited to be joined by Dr. Carrie Riddle, a wonderful professor from the Political Science Department, as well as one of her honors research students, Jessica Odishu.
Welcome to Global Tides, Dr. Riddle and Jessica.
Hey, thanks for having us.
All right, so to kick us off, could you both just give us a general overview of your research projects? Dr. Riddle, your research draws on critical and feminist theory and intersectionality. Maybe could you define those key terms for our listeners who might not be familiar with them, as well as touch on how these theories bring a unique perspective to this topic?
Yeah, absolutely. So those are all sort of interrelated, but critical theory really focuses on looking at things that are happening in the real world, looking for real injustices, and doing research that doesn't only try to explain what's happening, but maybe push towards social change. So critical theory is often connected with research with activism, often tied to marginalized groups and those sorts of things. Mm. And then adding a feminist lens to that is obviously focusing on women as actors, focusing on feminist themes, gender particular problems, things like that, right? And, you know, looking at women in the real world, looking at women's everyday lives, looking at their experiences with marginalization. And then intersectionality argues that gender can't really be understood in isolation from other sorts of social structures. So you need to be thinking about things like ethnicity or race, class. In a place like India, where I've done my research, caste is important. Are you indigenous or not? That was important in the piece that I'll be talking a little bit about today. All of those sorts of things mediate women's experiences, and so you need to have a decent understanding of how all of those social structures overlap and affect a woman's experience. So those are some of the insights for my project, which I'll obviously talk about a little bit more, but looking at both Indigenous and migrant women's experiences in a particular region of India in the Northeast.
That's awesome.
Amazing.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, and then Jessica, you say in your research that the framework of gender and development thought is the optimal framework to produce climate policy which benefits women. Could you summarize gender and development thought for listeners who might not be familiar with the term, and then just touch on your research a little bit?
Yeah, of course. There are multiple lenses to look at gendered studies of development. There are a lot like women in development, women and development. However, gender and development is really going to be more of a critique of those two lenses. Gender development really calls for structural change, right? So it's looking more at just not even bringing women into the process, but looking at how gendered power systems affect women, and specifically in climate action is really where I looked at it. In terms of my research, I really focused on gender and development in relation to responses to the Paris Agreement. So I was really trying to see if there is gender responsive policies being put in place, not just bringing women into the policy sphere by including them somehow, but also really just focusing on gendered systems of oppression within policy.
Yeah, wow, that is so interesting.
So interesting. So both of your research, as you have kind of outlined, discusses different themes such as gender, obviously, marginalized groups, development in India, topics such as those. We would love to hear a little bit more about what inspired you both to focus on the areas that you did.
For me, this is a multiple year journey. I've realized recently I've now been studying the particular region of India that I work on for more than a decade, which makes me feel really cool.
Congratulations.
Congratulations.
But feminism is just something that I became interested in because of my personal experiences with gender-based discrimination in various places, mm-hmm. At various institutions, unfortunately some religious institutions. Yeah. Our churches are not free from these problems, mm-hmm. right? So I sort of started studying feminism as a reaction to some of the things that I was seeing and experiencing. Mm-hmm. I'm just contrary like that. Mm-hmm. And so that was why feminism. And then India, honestly, it started with literature. So I wrote my English senior thesis on the novel Midnight's Children by Salman Rushdie, which mm-hmm. is an incredible magic realism perspective on Indian history. And it just mm-hmm. totally captured my imagination, and I just really wanted to get to India. So as I moved into graduate school, I got to go to Nepal as a master's student and then focused my dissertation research in India because of that interest and then other experiences that I had had. There was a really important professor for me at Notre Dame where I did my doctoral work who was from India, and he was an expert on Amartya Sen, who's one of the great development thinkers. So he really was able to steer me in some good directions as well. So a lot of different influences over a long journey. But yeah, that's the basic gist.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, what about you, Jessica?
Yeah, Dr. Riddle. Yeah.
The answer for a lot of us.
Exactly. She's just inspiration overall. But yeah, with India, growing up, most of my friends were from India. So I was really exposed to that culture, the food, the religion, everything. And I always wanted to go. Yeah. My mom always told me no. They would literally invite me to go with them and their families. My mom was freaked out. She would not let me leave the country without her. Yeah. I mean, I was probably like 10 years old.
Right, so fair.
It was a fair point. But it was almost a reaction, like, I want to go, like, I'm going to get there somehow, I'm going to be there. And then when I took Dr. Fabulous's class for international relations, mm-hmm. we were talking about, I think it was COP26, and India was proposing a phase down of coal usage instead of a phase out. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And for me, I was like, okay, that's the connection there, right?
That's awesome.
Looking a lot at climate policy was really going to be where I was seeing my strong suit.
Yeah.
And I was minoring in sustainability at the time, so I was also really interested in that.
Yeah.
And then I also took Dr. Riddle's Women in Politics class.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I remember the first day, she's like, well, why are you taking this class? And I was like, well, I want to use my thesis advisor. And
it's my way in.
Yeah, exactly. Like, okay, we'll talk.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so I just remember that first meeting, really talking to her, and I fell in love with the topic. I fell in love with feminist theories and really looking at that specifically when we got into talking about development. I'm now in her development class.
So yes.
Oh, nice.
She just can't escape me at this point. But yeah, that's really why I got into this.
No, I joke with her when we get to some topics in my development class. I'm like, you want to teach today?
Yeah.
You know everything I do at this point?
Oh,
gosh. You can take this one.
That's amazing. Oh, it's so cool. Thanks for sharing that. It's, mm-hmm. I think, one of the reasons we really were excited about interviewing both of you is just we know the personal connections and the real mm-hmm. passion behind mm-hmm. everything that you studied, and it's just really cool to see that shine through your work mm-hmm. too. Which, Jessica, you mentioned to us before this interview that you are continuing your work this summer yes. at an NGO in India, actually. We would love to hear a little bit more about that and what you'll be doing and kind of how you stumbled upon that experience as well.
Yeah, so I stumbled upon the Swanidhi Initiative because I was doing a project for my business ethics class mm-hmm. and I wanted to raise money for an NGO that I saw doing good work, and it connected to my thesis, so it just happened to really fall in line with me. So I ended up reaching out to the CEO. Her name is Ritwika Bhattacharya. So I reached out to her. She actually, her brother went to Pepperdine for a few years. So there was that immediate connection
there.
I ended up interviewing her for my Women in Politics class with Dr. Riddle. Mm-hmm. And we talked about women's empowerment and education in India. And during that interview, she offered me the internship.
Wow. Right out of that? Oh my goodness.
So I'm very, very excited. I'm going to be going and working in their New Delhi office for the Swanidhi Initiative for 60 days in the summer, where I'll mainly be doing research for different policy proposals, writing some of their pieces for them, really just working within the sectors and like learning as much as I can about governance in India for the most part. It is still kind of up in air how the internship's going to function, but I'm excited to learn more and really just be there. You know, I feel like it was just an amazing experience to really just be on the ground and working with people that are in a field that I'm incredibly interested in moving forward in. So,
That's incredible.
Congratulations.
You should be so proud of yourself.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, moving on. So this is obviously different for the both of you, but we would love to hear a little bit about sort of an outline of the research process and what that was like.
Yeah, so this particular piece called The Dispossessed, Indigenous and Migrant Views Against the Dominant Narratives on Citizenship in Northeast India. This is a collaboration with one of my dear friends, Bidisha Mahanta, who's from the Northeast. She's from the state of Assam. And we actually met on my first trip to India when it was just after my first year of my PhD. I think I was probably 25 and she was 23 or something like that. And it was her first job after college. Wow. So she was working for a peacebuilding NGO that I was interested in studying for my dissertation work. Cool. So we met kind of right away and just kind of instant kinship. She was almost immediately like a little sister that I didn't know I was missing in India. We got along great. I went to her family home several times. And we actually both ended up sharing some pretty serious critiques of that organization that I was studying and that she was working for.
Wow.
So we kind of bonded over that and just stayed in touch over the years. She's now a very successful publisher. So she works for a feminist publisher called Zaban Books that also does, they're kind of half NGO, half feminist publisher. Okay. So they're very active with women on the ground in promoting social change. And then they publish a lot of books and poetry and short stories and things like that by women that rarely have the chance to get their voices heard in something as formal as the publishing industry. Mm-hmm. So she's very much like in that place where academics meet activism, which is exactly the kind of thing that I like to study, right? Mm-hmm. So we have all these things in common, and I had brought her over to the U.S. for a conference a few years before, and so I was invited to contribute to an edited volume on critical and feminist approaches to peace and conflict studies, and the authors, the editors, were rightly concerned with having too many people from the Global North. We don't want only Global North voices in this volume. That's hugely important.
Yes.
And so, you know, those of us that they invited who were from Global North countries, they said, you know, if you have anybody in mind that you could co-author with, that would be really cool. And I immediately thought of my friend Bidisha.
Wow.
She's actually the one who came up with the specific topic, which I then had to learn a lot about.
Yeah.
I had worked a lot with indigenous peoples in the state of Manipur in Northeast India in my dissertation work. But this was my first exposure to the migrant population, some of whom came over during colonization. They were kind of brought in by the British. Mm-hmm. Some of whom came in later, mostly from Bangladesh, just looking for more economic opportunity and that sort of thing. So I was really grateful to her for sort of forcing me to learn a lot more about this topic, which is a recent controversy surrounding some of Prime Minister Modi's proposals around citizenship and things like that, which are perceived as very anti-Muslim. Mm. So anyway, lots of good topics for us to be studying. But so she came up with the topic. We worked together a lot on sort of developing the conceptualization of the chapter and things like that. Mm-hmm. She was the one who did the interviews because they were all her friends and family. Yes. Just her network.
Yeah.
So she recorded everything via video and then I transcribed everything that she had recorded. And then we worked together on analysis. And I think my favorite part about co-authoring was actually the convenience of the time difference.
Because
we were running up against a deadline to get our final draft in.
Yeah.
And I would work on it for several hours, and then I would go to bed, and then she would work on it for several hours while I was sleeping, and I would wake up, and all this work had been done.
It's 24/7 work.
So it was like, oh my gosh. 24 hours, you just keep going.
Yeah.
But it worked out to be a wonderful, wonderful process with her. And she actually was able to come to the International Studies Association conference in Montreal just a couple weeks ago.
Gosh.
And we were on a round table together.
Wow,
that was absolutely fantastic. I hadn't seen her since the pandemic. So that was great. It's been a wonderful, wonderful process.
Wow, that's amazing. Thank you so much. And Jessica, if you want to touch on sort of the research process for you, how has that been?
It's been good. So I'm in the honors research program for poli-sci students. Small little cohort of just a few of us.
Yeah.
It's been a whole year long process. The first semester we were learning just how to research, right? I guess undergraduate students were not really taught that process.
Yeah.
So we were really informed about the different sections, how to do an introduction, the literature design, like literature review, all of that kind of stuff. Our methodologies, that was a fun one.
Yeah, I know.
But mainly the research process was just so much reading, right? Because my research is all qualitative. There's not a lot of quantitative data that I'm really compiling at all. But I got most of my reading from Dr. Riddle.
I a really long list.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. I showed everyone in my cohort. I was like, look, I have the best advisor.
She's giving me all this material.
She's like, who's feeling
She was like, oh, these are all the people you need to look into. She compiled so much for me. My first semester was the easiest semester.
Yeah.
I
love that.
It
was
just me reading, and I was like, oh, this reading list is fantastic. Second semester, a lot more work trying to balance just being a regular classes and then also just doing my research on my own, right? It's a lot of time management skills that you really, really have to pick up on, right? It was a lot of learning, right? A lot of missteps, a lot of revisions, a lot of different learning the language of what you're writing about, right? Because obviously I don't have my PhD. I'm not in a master's program. I don't know what I'm doing. I'm an undergraduate student. So it was just amazing having Dr. Riddle in the process who could really just be like, this is not the phrasing you want to use. This is not what you're talking about. This is the theory you want to pull in here. It's just, I've learned so much in just doing a thesis paper that I could never learn in the class for one semester, you know?
So,
that whole research process really was just like probably the most informative thing I've ever done at Pepperdine.
Wow.
Oh, that's so cool.
That's amazing. I love your honesty in that too, because I think a lot of us end up in our senior year capstone classes, even throughout majors too, and all of a sudden we have this big thesis to write, and it's easy to kind of go down that rabbit hole of, I'm not a PhD student, I don't really have any training in this, I kind of have a lot of limitations on my project to what I like really want to find. But I mean, you obviously took what you had and ran with it and did something really cool. So I'm excited for that, because I think that will be really encouraging to hopefully other undergraduate students who listen to this. We would love if you guys want to dive in a little bit or as much as you want to into any findings or conclusions or really anything in particular that you want to highlight from your work that you find particularly exciting or fascinating that you want to share.
Yeah, so for me, I think something to share would be the importance of talking to people who are very differently marginalized. So this is one of the insights of people that work on methodologies related to concepts like intersectionality or feminism in general. You need to be really aware of different kinds of marginalization, right? And make sure that you're accounting, you can never 100% account for anything that might be marginalizing someone. I just don't think that's possible. But you need to be flexible and open to understanding real differences in people's situations. And so for my co-author and myself, for Bidisha and me, we really thought it was important to not only think about citizenship in light of how Indigenous people see it, or in light of only how migrant people see it, because they might be seen as, you know, possibly threatening one another. So Indigenous peoples in India have protected land, and that's really important for their ability to continue to have their own culture and their own language and the practices that they find important. But migrants are also incredibly vulnerable. Many of them, you know, may lack particular papers that are going to get them various benefits from the government and things like that. And so these are a couple of the most vulnerable groups that you're going to find in Indian society, and they have different kinds of vulnerability. So it's important not to equate them, but also to kind of consider them at the same time. Because they are also vulnerable. And so having those two populations both in mind throughout this project was really interesting and important. And then I think the thing that really surprised me was how similar their ideas for moving forward were, despite their differences in vulnerability. And, you know, it was a relatively small number of interviews. I think Bidisha was able to speak with maybe 9 people. So that's not a huge population, right? But still, we kept hearing very similar things related to kind of being able to tell your own story in your own words, not having people, especially from mainland India, sort of using their own lenses on the situation that the Indigenous and migrant people were facing. So in Indian politics, the Hindu-Muslim binary really captures so much of the political discourse. And that's just really not relevant for what's happening in the Northeast because of the way that ethnic relations are configured there. And so to hear both Indigenous and migrant people saying, well, that's not really helpful. That's not really what's going on. We need to be able to talk about what's happening on our own terms, sort of out from under the weight of this discourse that's used by so many people.
Right.
There were some times where some of the recommendations coming from the different groups were sort of counter to one another. So some respondents would say, you really need to pay attention to difference. I need to know your ethnicity, your caste, whether you're indigenous. Like, I need to know all of those things in order to kind of understand you. Mm-hmm. And other people would say, we need to get rid of all of that and get back to common humanity. Wow. So it wasn't all like, oh, we all think the same things, right? Yeah. Those are two very different strategies for trying to push back against vulnerability.
Yeah.
So you need to take both of those insights and think about how are we going to try to put those together? Because they seem really incompatible, right?
Right.
So, you know, it's not necessarily like very clear cut recommendations, but still a lot of sort of similar things coming from people who are very differently situated, which I found fascinating.
Yeah.
It's so fascinating. Wow.
And then Jessica, what about you? Are there any specific findings in particular that you would like to highlight or anything notable that you discovered throughout working on your project?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was just the lack of gender responsiveness in policy, right? Yeah. It just wasn't there. There was a few policies, like when I was looking at, I specifically looked at the sectors of energy, forestry, and agriculture, because those were in line with India's nationally determined contributions to the Paris Accord, the NDCs. And when I was looking at energy specifically, I was like, oh, well, you know, like women are disproportionately affected by coal pollution. Like this is something that has been studied, has been proven. You would think there would be some sort of inclusion of women into this space. Mm-hmm. No, very rare. And mainly focused on domestic issues, right? So you see with women cooking in poorly ventilated areas using coal pollution, you see household air pollution on the rise. You see different problems with anemia, different diseases coming up. So you would think like, okay, well, there's that, but also they're going and collecting the coal. There's other things going on that are affecting women outside of just the domestic sphere, right? There's a productive reason for the... it's just beyond just domestic uses, right?
Yeah.
And so when you're looking at policy... you're seeing an inclusion of women, right? You're seeing that it's gender sensitive, but it's really not responsive, right? So there's just a lack of that. And I think my most shocking finding is when I was analyzing the Paris Agreement, because coming from a Western perspective, I'm like, oh, the Paris Agreement, like this is going to be the gold standard. It's the only climate agreement that includes women, talks about gender responsiveness. Fantastic.
Right.
Yeah. It's going to be in line with GAD.
No.
Farthest from the thing. Actually, I found that it was, I argue that it's more in line with women in development thought, because it really is just, in my argument, of where more performative rhetoric around responsiveness. Because when you look at where it actually has a lack of talking about women, you see that in mitigation, climate financing, climate technologies, all the things that like really affect women, no mention of gender whatsoever. It's completely gender blind. So it, in my opinion, at least, and this was the most shocking thing coming from my studies, that an agreement that is really pushing itself forward as bringing in women, right, and talking about gender, really is just continuously lacking. And we see this in not just in India, right? It's an international problem.
Yeah.
So that was probably my biggest finding.
Wow. Yeah. So important.
Yeah.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
So now, just kind of to wrap up, we would love to ask you guys, I mean, we have gained so much from listening to you both talk about your different research projects, and we know our listeners will as well. But if you could just kind of summarize one thing that our listeners could take away from your research, or really we're just kind of asking the question, what significance does it hold for all of us tuning in, whether it's us students listening here in Malibu or kind of wherever we're at, what is something that you would like to leave people with?
I think one thing I'm really concerned with right now in U.S. politics and also other places around the world, there are just so many attacks on, quote, wokeism, on diversity education, gender sensitivity, right? So this is really coming under fire right now. And I think it's just so important to really strongly push back on that because it's just so obvious to me the things that you miss if you're not actively looking for intersectional vulnerabilities. And even if you have the best intentions in the world, you are going to harm people if you're not doing that kind of analysis. And so I just think it's really important to persist in teaching those tools, using those tools in research, introducing them to people who maybe have, let's say, the Fox News version of what intersectionality is, but don't know what Kimberly Crenshaw says it is.
Yeah.
I think it's really, really important to continue to insist on those tools and how important they are for justice.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome.
Amazing.
Yeah, for me, it's very similar to Dr. Riddle. Mm-hmm. I think just like looking at who is this policy affecting, you know, like even in our daily lives, right? We can look at the very basic level, but then when you actually dig deep, like, is there anyone this is affecting negatively, right? Like, if we're looking at a policy and they mention women, let's say like a healthcare policy and they discuss women, well, like, are women just being included just to be included, or is it more of a responsive policy towards their needs?
Mm-hmm.
And I think, like, especially at Pepperdine, right, like, looking, especially in poli-sci, if you're a poli-sci major, this is so critical, right, is really looking at, like, whatever you're studying, right, is there any marginalized group that's affected differently, and is there any way that we can try to combat that? And I think especially as undergraduate students moving forward in our careers, just being very receptive to listening to other people, right?
Yeah.
Like, we're so blessed at Pepperdine. We go to a private school in Malibu, right?
Yeah.
We're very, very blessed, but it's easy to put ourselves in a bubble, especially as undergraduate students.
Yeah.
So I think just expanding that bubble and really just trying to be cognizant, you know, as young adults of, like, our actions, but also the actions of our local governments, our federal government, international communities. So I think that that's incredibly important moving forward for all of us.
Yeah. Wow.
Couldn't agree more.
I really appreciate that too. I hope your both of your kind of urge to the listeners, I hope it leaves people feeling encouraged to continue seeking out different perspectives than maybe what they have always had.
Yes.
I know it is encouraging me to do that. So. But we have so loved having you guys on. Thank you so much for sharing about your different projects and your different experiences.
Your work is very admirable, and thank you for being willing to share it with us and with the greater Pepperdine community.
Yeah, thanks for the invitation. Thank you for having
us.
Yay! Thanks so much for joining us on this episode. We'll see you next time here on Global Tides. Mm-hmm.